You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. I'm here at the Edinburgh Festival and this is going to be slightly on the fly because obviously it's a pretty busy festival. I'm not planning to put out every show as and when, as you'll be aware. They've been going on for about a week now. We've had some incredible interviews, but this you'll have to forgive me if these are slightly less organised than the ones that I'm able to calmly release after the festival is concluded. This is Brendan Burns and I'm going to let him speak for himself. I think out of all of a lot of the early interviews that I did this Fringe, Brendan is someone that I feel I knew well enough to really get stuck into and pin him down on a few things. I'm very proud of this conversation, and I will let him do most of the talking. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Brendan Burns.
Thanks, man.
Hey, man.
Thank you very much for coming, Brendan.
Yeah, you want a quarter-filled room, you put my name on the ticket.
Oh, yeah. let's start with... I'm sure that the listenership of the podcast that's going to go out of this show will be very familiar with your work. There is a chance, however small, that some of these people will have wandered in here to avoid... the inclement weather. So for the benefit of them, could you describe what your comedy is like? Who are you for people that don't know you?
Oh, God. Does anyone ever answer that seriously?
It's the first time I've asked it. I thought you'd be a perfect guinea pig.
I remember actually,
I just think because there's humans in the room that sometimes are like, oh, a ticket to something. Yeah, it might be worth just to, before we get into the stuff.
I don't know. I guess I've always been a fan of I'm reminded of a story years ago. There was a black American comedian called Patrice O'Neill, and he was on the road and he told me secondhand this story where this was when I was younger and I was very, very quick to define what I was doing.
Yeah.
And some guy said to him, so what kind of comedy do you do? And Patrice went, man, what motherfucker answers that fucking question? Do you ever ask a fucking comedian that question? What asshole answers that question? And the guy said, well, Brendan Burns did, and he talked for an hour.
Well, I thought you'd be the ideal person to try that question out on, just as a sort of an introductory thing, because your shows, certainly your Edinburgh shows, are the ones that I've seen, are very much focused on you. You seem to fairly relentlessly mine your personal experience for your comedy. You're not doing sort of gentle observations about...
Oh, I would argue that all stand-up does that. I'm just way more honest about it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that. Why is that?
I mean, you look at every single themed show or every single stand-up show in this. It's the most self-absorbed art form there is. Mm-hmm. It just is, right? But the reason why we get away with it is there's a payoff for you because there's a laugh. You know, that's why you come. But otherwise, it would just be you'd effectively just be going, paying good money to watch a man blow himself for an hour. So we like to wear a funny hat to keep you entertained while we're just self-filating. And maybe that's why sticks in some people's craw is because they want to deny that they're doing that. But
yeah, okay.
You know, world events, even topical comics, is still like, you know, wouldn't things be better if I was running them?
Okay.
You know, I used to do topical comedy, and then I don't know, but I was a very angry topical comic.
Sure.
And then it became very apparent to me, hang on, wait a minute. My reaction to the ills of the world is to travel to the world's biggest arts festival and have people applaud me for pointing out to them. And I kind of realized that was a vanity bordering on conceit. Okay. And so I thought, every show you care to... What's your show about this year?
I'm just doing this one. This is about other people. This is my year.
Oh, so it's what
off.
Happens when you talk to comics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, you know, you look at most theme shows, it's what happened when I went and did this. It's, you know, it's always still about the person because as an art form, I think no other art form really taps into... For me, personally, it's really about finding out who you are. You know, okay. And that's forever, you know, and trying your damnedest to just be authentic, sure. You know, and...
Is that successful, do you think? If your shows have been intended to find out who you are, have they worked in that? Have you found
absolutely.
Out more about yourself?
Absolutely. My director, Paul Byrne, who unfortunately is had to leave the festival early, sure. And he's worked with a lot of people, but, you know, sometimes I'll come up with something, but the one key direction he will give me sometimes is, it's not really you. You know,
okay.
Or you're talking from the chip on your shoulder, or you're talking too much of what you're doing other people's thinking for them, or you're worried too much about what other people's perceptions are of you. And that really gets in the way of your, you know, authenticity.
So when you're, that's interesting. I was aware, I think, that you'd worked with directors in the past. Is Paul always your director now?
Hopefully, yeah.
Okay.
You know, as much as possible, yeah.
And
he and I can get like, to watch us have a conversation after a show.
Yeah.
You know, there's no sugarcoating. We're just getting a job done.
Sure.
I see other people going, look, it's great, and there's wonderful stuff in there, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. It's like, tell me what to take out. What didn't work? What goes here? Come on, you know, let's not fuck around.
Okay. And does he play a kind of a creative role in the show, or is he there as a soundboard for you to, you try all the stuff, and he says yes or no? How does that relationship work?
It's more like a brotherhood.
Okay.
I think he first started out directing comedy. I think I was his first. He and I were working together.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's his full-time job.
Okay.
So there's an understanding between the pair of us that it's just, you know, we get a day's work done in seconds. You know, that I think other people would be labouring over and arguing back and forth. And
that's because of that honesty. Again, that's what you were talking about before, is that you have an honest relationship with him. Do you feel you have an honest relationship with your audience?
Absolutely.
You're 100% honest with him?
Absolutely. I mean, the opening line, you saw the show last night, is I'm so painfully unfamous, I recognise the audience.
Yeah.
And someone made a criticism one year, Claire Smith from The Scotsman, she brought people along, and some people get offended sometimes because they say that I talk as if I expect the crowd to know who I am,
mm-hmm.
but quite the opposite. I expect me to know them.
Okay.
And so it's because I've given no one any reason to come and see me. You know,
okay.
Anyone new. It's always, you know, it's true. You know, I'm on telly once every 5 years and I fucked that up. So it's either fans or friends of fans that have been dragged along. Or unless, you know, I write the occasional hit show.
Sure.
And then you get the odd transient coming in.
Okay. And how do you... Is that a kind of a conclusion that you've come to after years? Like, you're someone who's been to the Edinburgh Festival. As long as I've been coming here, I'm sure I've seen posters.
Yeah, my
first
was in 96 and I've only missed two.
Okay. And you have presumably...
And that's hilarious to me as well now, like, as my beard gets greyer. It's hilarious to me now that people go, wow, 96. And I'm like, I was fucking back then. That's not... You know, like, you get to a certain age and the really, like, a long time ago is probably pre-virginity. Is that about right? Like, look at you.
Okay, but so in all your years of coming to Edinburgh, have you always been that honest? Is that something you started off, like, when you first started comedy?
Sorry, I've got my phone on. That's very, very wrong of me.
That's quite all right. I'll fill.
isn't his beard grey?
Yeah, it is. But I'm glad it's grey now, as opposed to, it used to have Trampy Ginger in there. And I couldn't let it go.
That sounds like a singer.
Trampy Ginger? Hey, hasn't that replaced, remember the really shit gag of when you're like, students used to make it, that could be the name of our indie band.
Oh, yeah.
And Edinburgh has a new one now. That should be the name of your show next year.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
That could totally be next year's show.
So we were talking about honesty. So let's talk about how you started as a comedian and whether you are like the change that's taken place between how you started and the sort of comedian that you are now. What was the circumstances of your first comedy performance? How did you bring yourself to it?
It's the worst beginning of comedy story ever.
Okay.
Like, everyone talks about their first gig, and mine's the worst.
Okay.
It's probably where the anger started. I'd always been the funny one in my family. I'd wanted to be a comic since I was 9 years of age. I first saw Flip Wilson in Texas. Very formative trip, actually. I was traveling with my family on business. I saw my first stand-up comedian, Flip Wilson, black American comedian. Mm-hmm. First guy to rally, you know, do stuff about race and really go after race relations before Pryor, before, he's a precursor to everyone, right?
Okay.
And I remember at 9 years of age, he walked out, and it's Texas, 1980, and he's the only black guy in the room. It's like Stetson hats and shit. And it's the old kind of comic, right, as well. Like, he's got a tux, he's got a band, full-on band, all white band. And it goes, ba-da-ba-ba, please welcome Flip Wilson, ba-da-ba-ba. And he just like points to the guy, his band leader, and his opening line in All Right Room is, does your daddy know you work for a nigger? It'd kill him. And the whole room was just stunned silent, right? And I'd never even heard that word before, right? Yeah. And I'm like, And then there was this beautiful moment just hanging in the air of people tried to work out who the butt of the joke was. And then they realized that it was their received racism.
Okay.
So he stood on the rug and pulled it out from underneath himself and them.
Sure. Right?
And then there was a laugh. But there was this wonderful moment of limbo of whether you don't know the chair's going to fall all the way back or you're going to land flat on your feet. And that moment of limbo, I just remember being so, just so mystified by it, so enamored by it, so just that hang time.
Sure.
I just remember as a 9-year-old kid, I was like, I want to do that.
Okay.
And
So what was it that drew you to it? Because I'm familiar with that story from your show, so I suppose this is offensive now.
Yes. So from all through my childhood, everyone else was getting into, you know, when people had their Beatles and their Rolling Stones phase or whatever, like everyone did, you know, they had their bands they liked. I liked comedy. And I had like all Richard Pryor's albums. I had Eddie Murphy. I was a huge fan of black American comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's actually taken me 23 years to discover that I've tried to emulate black American comedy, which is why I've been punched a lot. turns out I don't have the same license. But it's really weird, like going back to old footage as well, I was under the impression that whenever I was doing that, I was like cutting truths, you know, and I was looking really cool and slick, and I go back and look at old photos, I look so fucking camp every time. I really was like, oh, you know my point, I'm under the impression I'm doing that shit, right? And I was like I'm a lobster.
What period is this you're talking about? Because I want to agree with you, but I don't want to agree with you and then you go, oh, I didn't mean then.
No, probably still now as well. Okay. Now I just embrace the campness.
Sure. I remember when I first met you, you were wearing a black leather jacket and a red kind of handkerchief around your head and blue jeans. And I absolutely had you pegged as one of those kind of journeyman comics. It's like, I'm on my road, I'm on my path. Everything about my life is comedy and I'm a wild-eyed loner. And I'm looking like, you know, you were like, it looked like you thought you were the Mad Max of comedy. Do you know what I mean? You were just like,
yeah, that's probably true.
Okay, well, okay.
Yeah, I'll wear that.
Sure, okay. So was that
honest at
the time?
That's why whenever I see some young lad, like on stage, going, what am I fucking with your minds, people? Am I too edgy? I'm at the back just wanting to yell, you just want to be loved.
Yeah.
You're frightened and you're afraid everyone will find out you're charming. It's a dumb thing to be scared of.
And you know about that. You know about that because you've seen that from the inside. Because
we'll get back to the how I started. So obsessed with comedy all my life. I used to do a stand-up and we used to do a comedy concert at school, which, believe me, is way more frightening than beginning stand-up comedy in front of your school. Sure. And we had a fake breakdance band, me, Steve Lee, and Michael Cusack, who I think is now the Minister for Arts.
Yeah, so fuck him.
I think he's running for mayor of Perth or something. But and we had a fake breakdance band called the Sonic Wheelbases.
Okay.
And, you know, and I got my first laugh in front of that with a rap song for the deaf, which was really offensive. And it's staggering that I was allowed to do that at school. And but that's when I got the bug. There was the pop. You know, I went for it. And I'd always been the funny one in my family. And, you know, given speeches and always kind of was pretty good at, you know, holding a crowd's attention. And then my sister was in a car accident. She lost her husband and a kid. Mm-hmm. And she's always been like the closest member of my family. And my nephew is like my, you know, is as close to a son as my son is.
Sure.
You know, to this day. And, but it's the only time that my family had ever been reliant on me. Mm-hmm. And they went, you've got to come over and cheer us up because you've always been the funny one. This happened in England. Mm-hmm. So I came over, worst day of my life. So I walked in, saw my sister in traction, saw the dead baby, saw my nephew who was four, and his first thing he says to me is, Uncle Renan, my dad's dead, right? And I'm like, oh, I've got to step up, you know. You know, I've got to, you know, be more involved in this guy's life. And while all this is going on, because bearing in mind I come from Perth, Western Australia, there's no opportunity to do open spots. While all this is going on, I went, I'll book myself an open mic. Because I'm fucking mental. Because there's a huge difference. I'm going into shtick. I've done this on stage before, so sure. Excuse me if it's too practiced.
That's okay. That's all right.
But it's because there's a huge difference between being a funny guy and a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
Because I've seen plenty of funny guys. You know, this is an obsession. This is a social disorder.
Okay.
It's a social disorder.
Sure,
being
sure.
able to talk in front of a room full of people about your most humiliating things yeah. is a complete and utter social disorder. It's love from strangers.
Why did you? I appreciate you've told this story before. I want to stop you.
I'm still not done yet.
Okay.
I've segued.
like all the best segues, you have to point it out.
Yeah. And so you know, I've seen funny people start out in stand-up comedy, and the first time they get booed off, mm-hmm. they just go, "I can't go through this again," and they walk out of the room, never to be seen again. A stand-up comic will get booed off and try and get back up that same night wearing a different hat.
Sure. Okay.
Declaring, wasn't that last guy shit, right? Which was my opening line for the first 5 years. And so while all this was going on, right, I booked myself an open mic night. And you have to bear in mind, this was 1990, right, in England. And PC, we'd just come off the back of PC, which was alternative comedy, which started out as well-meaning but really turned into basically a middle-class white art form entertaining middle-class white people who all determine where the boundaries of taboo lie.
Okay.
Kind of bigoted.
Okay.
But very covert bigotry, very sneaky, not really aware of itself. And in those days, if you got up with this accent and my demeanour, whole room would shut down. You know, okay. bearing my demeanour in
mind. Oh, you mean because they were middle-class white people and you weren't
just like, oh, good Lord, a convict daring to talk to us, right?
Really?
Yeah.
In the 90s?
You fucking bet. You bet. Dude, I still get it to this day. It is staggering to me who feels it's okay to say to me, oh, I never knew you were quite clever. I'm like, fuck you.
Okay.
You know,
were you not at the time wearing a black leather jacket and a red handkerchief and doing your best to look like an unreconstructed convict?
Valid point. We make our beds. Yeah, you got a point there. I'll wear that. you got a good point there. But at that time, I actually didn't look like that. I was a rather fresh-faced child.
Okay.
And maybe that mask of the leather jacket and all that sort of shit came after this.
Sure.
I booked a gig and it was an open mic night. Also bearing in mind, it's a very friendly room. It's a bringer show. It's friends mm-hmm. of the open spots. Mm-hmm. I get up, I'm filled with rage because while all this was going on and I was looking after my sister, my best friend back home fucked my girlfriend. Right, so I felt very betrayed. So I got on stage and I was very angry at women because I wasn't old enough to process the difference between one woman doing this to me and all women. So I'm just doing this gig from hell. I've done no preparation because I'm sitting there thinking I've killed every gig I've ever done in front of basically practicing in front of my friends. Mm-hmm. So I've done no preparation and I'm just screaming and yelling, going, you're all shit at giving head. Show me how you suck a dick on the microphone. Show me. And it's a bringer show and there's these nice ladies going, oh, what's happening? Right, and eventually I broke down And I just said, this is my first ever gig. And I broke down after 5 minutes and just started screaming at the audience going, why don't you cunts think I'm funny? Why don't you think I'm funny? And eventually the compere goes, come off, come off. And I walked to the back of the room. To make matters worse, my parents were in videotaping the entire thing. And as I walked past my dad and I said, please tell me you stopped taping that. And he said, and I quote, son, I stopped recording the moment the first tear of shame hit my cheek.
Okay.
At which point I thought, this is the life for me.
Okay. You're, and I realise there's an audience here, but you're performing this story right now.
Yes, because I've perfected it because I've been asked it.
Yeah, sure. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Actually, you know what? My friend Colt Cabana gets mad about that as well. Yeah. It's like he sees me do a bit later on. But let's face it, as you said, my act is quite emotionally.
Well, I think for someone who is honest and who is talking about real things, and I think honestly, in the preparation of the research I've been doing ahead of all the interviews I've been doing here, you for me have been a revelation, because I think I as a comedy viewer, when I was coming to the Fringe 15 years ago, before I was a comic, I thought it was kind of easy to write you off as this kind of journeyman thing that wouldn't be the sort of thing I'd be interested in. And the more of your shows I've gone back and listened to since, I've genuinely gone, holy fuck, Brendan's actually saying something. Because I as a punter, was completely put off by the leather jacket, the aggro, the attitude on your posters when you were...
Absolutely,
I remember
right.
A quote on one of your posters that said, all the quotes on everyone else's posters is massage, lies, half-truths. Everyone else's quotes are bullshit. These are the real quotes. I was like, this guy's an asshole. Do you know what I mean?
And but so that put me off seeing your fringe. Stuff.
Well, yeah, okay, but and to be fair, you were sort of dressed as Conan on a throne, but yeah. but you see what I mean? Maybe that's a bad example, but the point I'm making is that I found it easy to write you off because you came with, you kind of brought so much what seemed to me to be faux aggression, and you know, it didn't seem to be honest, and I thought I think I know what I'm going to get from this.
Oh,
I'm
no,
gonna
I get was a angry. Guy. I was angry for a very long time.
Okay.
That's why I was being honest before when I said I'm going into shtick now, because I've been asked this and I've practiced the story.
Sure.
Which, I gave you the heads up.
Yeah, yeah, that's okay. Try to tell the story without telling the
chip
the
on the shoulder that,
that
Paul
practiced.
And I always try and work against is I hate condescension.
Okay.
But at the same time, I'm a very contrary individual, so sometimes I try and create a situation that people, that basically pricks, I see a, all right. I see a bigotry in this country that I don't think it's aware of.
Okay.
I think it's thousands of years old,
mm-hmm.
and thousands and thousands of years old, and it's usually exposed when people least think they're doing it.
Okay.
And it's born on elitism, it's born on classism, it's born on accent. That's why people, when they go to university, they change the way they speak.
Sure.
If they want to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
And I fucking hate it.
Okay.
I hate it. Because I've lived...
You hate it because you've personally experienced it, because you felt when you were going on stage as a young comic in this country, is that what you're saying? That you felt there was an elitist audience that sneered at you, didn't rate you, weren't prepared to listen to you.
Also, I never judge a book by its cover.
Okay.
Ever. I refuse to condescend to anyone. No matter what their disability, their creed, their religious background, whatever, particularly if everyone comes into clown school, as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned, they're way more my brothers than anyone else.
Sure.
You know, the fact of the matter is I know somewhere something happened that broke their heart and they need love from strangers.
Sure.
And not only that, they got booed off and they didn't quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point,
so
everyone's been booed off.
Absolutely.
Every comic has been booed off and didn't quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people that get booed off and go into criticism.
Sure.
And sometimes there are critics that are very, very patronizing. And it's like, you know what? You lower down the evolutionary rung.
Sure.
Because you tried, you failed, and you gave up.
Absolutely. I understand that. And
I've got a massive chip on my shoulder. You can hear it talking now. And
sure.
Gets in the way of my comedy.
Okay. So, I mean, it seems to me that what you're talking about in terms of other comedians and, you know, not condescending to people, that's what you're talking about there is community. It's a sense that we're a gang. You and I and anyone else in this room who's been a stand-up.
And sometimes I've experienced it. I've lived in England a long time. I've experienced it from other comics.
Okay.
And it's...
And when you say it, you mean condescension.
Condescension and also kind of a pseudo left-wing pretension.
Okay.
There is actually a wafer-thin veil over a very, very covert,
okay,
covert prejudice.
Sure.
And you know,
and
what?
You're angry with this prejudice because
I'll talk
you feel
to women,
like...
I'll talk to black comics, I'll talk to disabled comics about it, and we all see it. And the funny thing is, the Australian thing doesn't count, mm-hmm, because this is a select group of people that get to tell, that get to determine who the ethnic minorities are.
Okay.
And
you mean
I'm still,
comedians? Comedians?
I'm an ethnic minority, and no one considers it.
Okay.
I'm an Australian living in England. I'm an immigrant. I'm therefore from a different culture. I'm an ethnic minority, but no one knows.
Okay. Who are you talking about, that small group of people? Do you mean comedians? Who are the small group of people who decide that?
I think
that?
There's a new subset of comics that are turning into, that have received so much acclaim from critics that they've turned into them.
Okay.
And I've seen it happen.
Is
over
this,
the course
you
of
were
years.
Talking about Stuart Lee and the material that you were...
I make fun of Stu.
Yeah, sure.
I love Stu.
Yeah.
Here's the thing as well. I love Stu. I hate his audience.
Okay. It was very funny.
Hate
your stuff
audience.
On that last night is very, very good.
Hate his audience.
Yeah.
Of this whole idea of the backslapping for comprehending jokes.
Yeah.
You know, I think I even forgot the joke last night. It's an involuntary response. The reason that you laugh is because you're surprised. It's an involuntary response. If you want to go, I'm so clever, I understood that. It's a stupid joke. It doesn't make sense. But it's, you know, it's an involuntary response. If that's the case, how come when someone sneezes, instead of bless you, we don't go, you're a fucking genius? Yeah, it's a dumb joke. But and the thing is, guys like Stu and Rich Herring, I don't actually count in this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually count in this because when I was coming up, and they had every reason. They were 20-something comics who were famous. They had a TV show.
Yep.
And they were great to other 20-something comics.
Mm.
I will never forget that, how cool they were, how supportive they were when, you know, they saw something in me and my peers coming up as well. And they were like, it's really great, you know, and they would talk to you for ages when you were, like, opening for them or whatever.
So, and I'm not asking you necessarily
what
to
I
name
don't
any
like
names, but...
is a subset. You know what? There's already an us and a them. I've written an article about it, actually, this week. There already is an us and a them.
Okay.
We don't need another subset.
Okay.
There's already plenty of criticism going.
Sure.
And the bottom line is, be honest, you know, you want to kill yourself alternative or whatever, be honest. Who would you rather share a car with? John Bishop or Brian fucking Logan?
Yeah. Sure. Just for the benefit of the listener there, John Bishop is all you'll know is a comedian, and Brian Logan is the critic for The Guardian.
Whose even positive reviews managed to be condescending.
Sure. He certainly, I don't, he doesn't seem to like comedy very much in many of the reviews of his.
No, I don't think he likes stand-up, and he makes his living off the back of it.
Sure.
And you know what? Everyone's afraid to say it, but fuck it.
So this is Brendan. I imagine most of you will be familiar with him. There will be people in remote corners of the world who aren't familiar with his work. And it's certainly worth tracking some of it down, as I've either already said or I'm about to say on the show. And as I said, this intro is done on the fly and not written, so forgive me for not knowing. But Brendan is someone who really genuinely talks about subjects. There's no fluff. He really is very adept at getting his teeth into the meat of an actual socio-political issue or a sexual issue or a personal issue, and really not letting go of it until he's wrung a lot of comedy out of it. So I hope you find this conversation as stimulating as I did, and I hope you enjoy it. So listen, guys, I've been plugging the live shows to you for ages. I'm aware that some of you are coming to see them, which I really appreciate. Let's be honest, I'm doing a live show of something that you can download for free later, and I know a lot of people prefer to listen to podcasts, you know, in the bath or whilst driving or what the hell. But it really would be good for me to make any money at all back from this process whatsoever if you came to see the live shows. And you'll see, if you're on a long flight or a journey and you've came three or four of them, you can probably hear in my voice the switch around I've done from, hey man, the shows are selling really well, come and see them, to, please come and see the shows. I don't know quite what the issue is. I suspect that there's an awful lot of podcast conversational stuff happening, but I think we're genuinely, and again, when I say we, I mean me, I think I'm genuinely producing something unique here. So I'm I would be very pleased to see more people through the door here at the Edinburgh Festival. So if you are listening to this one in August and you are arriving at the festival later, do come along and see it. If you've got a gilded balloon pass, make use of it, because I'd rather have a body in the room than not, even if you're getting in free. And also, yeah, just kind of, if you wouldn't mind tweeting about it, if you wouldn't mind right now when you're listening to this, if you could tweet something nice about the podcast, mention it's on at 5:15 p.m. in the Gilded Balloon and put the hashtag Ed Fringe on it, that would certainly help me out. If we could have a bit of a flood of people that do that as soon as you finish this episode, I would really appreciate that. I was going to get all street performery on you and go, hey, I've given you a thing for free and you can decide. I'm not going to try and neurolinguistically program you here, but I'd certainly appreciate your help, because this is one of the few times of the year when I try to make some money out of the podcast as opposed to spending money and time. I sound a bit like Herring now. I hope you enjoyed that one. I've had a lot of very positive feedback about the Richard Herring podcast. I was very proud of that one. And of the shows we've had so far, we've had some genuinely revelatory shows. You guys are going to go absolutely mental for the interview I did with Tony Law just yesterday. The Greg Proops episode was superb. We really got into a lot of depth and detail, some of it about my purpose life, my personal life, in the conversation with David Baddiel, who turned the tables on me. Phil Nickel, Norman Lovett, Hal Cruttendon, they're all good episodes. I'm sure you're going to enjoy them as and when they come out, and I'll put them out as soon as I can. In the meantime, have a wonderful festival if you're up here. Have a wonderful August. If you're not, I shall return you now to Mr. Brendan Byrne.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We've shifted from, and this is, we're within the bounds of talking about your anger, but we've shifted from your anger at comedians, your anger at audiences, your anger at critics.
Yeah.
You're obviously an angry guy. We get that.
No, I'm not, though. You asked me what made me angry.
Okay.
And I said, that gets in the way. I think that gets in the way of being whole. Because you know how people say, some people, I think it should be about a complete lack of censorship. And some people confuse that with just being disgusting for an hour.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is, no one is a fully, wholly disgusting human being. If you're up there just basically saying the worst thing you can think of for an hour, you are censoring yourself.
Okay.
Because, you know, what about the things you love? What about the things that you, you know, it's just all about being complete.
Yeah. Okay, I feel like a lot of your...
So back to that point, so that thing that I'm trying to get out of my system so that it doesn't infect my show.
Okay.
That we were talking about here is, as I said, there's already an us and a them. You know what? It just miffs me a little. I don't even have beef with critics. I really don't. I think there's some brilliant ones. Mm-hmm. And there are some brilliant ones that fucking hate me. Mm-hmm. You know, that I still like Kate Copstick couldn't stand me for years. I still kind of liked her.
Sure.
I do. Look, give her 10 years when her demeanor, her age fits her demeanor, and she will be adorable. Do you know what I'm saying? She is a 90-year-old woman trapped inside a 70-year-old woman's body. She would love that.
She would love that.
She would love that joke. She would love that joke. And what I respect about her is even the stuff that she hates, she injects enough of her personality into it that you know if it wouldn't be your cup of tea, she could give something 5 stars and you would still be able to be turned away from it going, that's for her, not for me.
Sure. Okay, okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I absolutely understand that, but I really want to pin you down onto this issue.
So what I'm saying is I don't like it when people... sorry. What I'm saying is I don't like it when people sell us out to get themselves over with them. Mm-hmm. Because nothing panders to critical acclaim more than slagging off people that pander. It's pandering.
Sure.
It's a whole brand new subset of pandering. And it's, you know, everyone, you know, we all know the Edinburgh tricks. Bring it down at 45.
Yeah.
Because people have seen 5 stand-up shows in a day. And anyone doing anything other than trying to make a room full of people laugh, it's a break. You know, do something earnest at 45. But above all, make the pseudo-pundit feel like he's an expert.
Sure.
Congratulate him for understanding something.
Sure.
3 goes to 4, 4 goes to 5. And everyone knows it.
Yeah.
Everyone, it's a this secret. Is,
we're almost talking in code here. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Four stars goes to five.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Okay, bring it down at 45. At the 45-minute mark, but you've been killing for 45, right? Killing for an hour is the toughest thing to do. Because again, we're invoking an involuntary response. It's a hot room. It's not a cynical crowd, but certainly a savvy crowd. There's more aficionados in Edinburgh than your average audience. Let's face it, right? So that's hard to lift the roof off the place for an hour. That is the challenging bit. But if you've got something that's highly thematic. Everyone knows this, and this is a dilemma that everyone goes through before they come up here.
Sure.
Explain one of your jokes, say what you're not, and at 45 minutes, bring it down and do something heartfelt and earnest so that it is showing that you have a range, and possible acting range, so that a lot of people that, you know... It's true. So that people that also basically generally that review theatre and don't really know much about comics and comedy... That appeals to them because they've watched five stand-ups in a row, lift the roof off the place, and I defy anyone to watch fucking five stand-ups in a row. I get that. That's a big ask. So if you do something different and then show that range and then with a culminating in a well-constructed closer, three stars goes to four stars goes to five.
So that basically, and I think we've all, comedy fans certainly will have seen that and we'll all know of people that we think might be guilty of that who basically have played the system.
I've pandered to it.
I was going to ask, do you feel that you've had a part in creating that system? You've done thematic shows, I wonder where that system came from. It's kind of quite widely known now that if your dad dies 40 minutes in, you're onto a winner.
That's why me and Paul Byrne, my dad died last year, right? And we tried to break that rule.
Yeah.
By trying to get to it in the first 10.
Yeah, okay.
Because I pulled my life for stand-up. And it was like, you do it at 10, you're taking a big risk. No one's really ready for it at 10.
Sure.
And they're going, but I want to get it out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Do you think, though,
it's terrible to say that of my fucking father. I want to get my dad's death out of the way. All right? So, it was very inconvenient.
Do you think you've had a part, though, in...
Probably.
Because you've done thematic shows, do you think that you have been part one of the people that has that's created that genre of a revelatory show? Because again, you had shows about Brendan versus Burnsy about the two sides of your personality. You had shows about alcohol. You had a show about sex addiction. Your new show touches on your recently discovered deafness. And each of your shows, that the nature of making a revelation, the nature of making a show that has a revelatory aspect to it, do you feel that you're kind of hoping for stuff to happen, or?
Oh, that was certainly part of the addiction.
Okay.
When years ago.
By the time of your third addiction show, I kind of went, really?
It wasn't about addiction. The third one. I mean, the first one was about the breakup. I wrote a trilogy. Part one was separating my onstage persona and offstage persona after splitting up with my fiance. Then part two was about me trying to search for consolation by handing out mushrooms at the Glastonbury Festival and ringing her live one year to the day that she divulged that she was seeing someone else. And then the third one was, it turned out I went mad. So the third one wasn't necessarily about sobriety. That was more about the actual writing of the trilogy. Someone wrote to me afterwards and said, did you write the trilogy because you were crazy, or did the writing of the trilogy drive you crazy? Because part two, basically, I was trying to do what you're describing, the revelatory magic button.
Sure.
So I was addressing that and I was searching for that. But the fact of the matter is, I was getting up every night talking about stuff that I was very, very fucking angry about.
Okay.
And at the top of the show, I was furious, and then I did the final neat let her go ending.
Yeah.
And then I got it back up the following night and I did it again.
Okay.
And it's a rehab cliche, isn't it? The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Do you think you can still be honest, though, when to a certain extent you're pulling strings and pushing buttons and you're creating the reality of the show? You're talking about honest, and I'm not just talking about, I don't just mean this about your own work, but the way stand-ups have revelatory or painful experiences
to
relive it every night.
When something really bad is happening, there is an obsession of sometimes going, I've got to get something out of this.
Yeah.
But now I have a very, very different attitude because I did that in 2005 and it drove me crazy. I actually got locked up. I got sectioned. Even in rehab, I got sectioned, which is... So even in the fucking group, you get sedated and removed.
Okay.
And I had a full-on psychotic episode. Like, I'd done too many hallucinogens. I saw Satan twice. Once looking in the mirror, not a pleasant exercise. That's how the beard went grey. Went grey overnight. I shit you not, went grey overnight. I didn't have a grey beard.
Okay, let me put this to you. That may very well, I'm not disagreeing with any of it. I'm not saying that any of it's not true. But can you see how from the outside that sounds a bit like, a lot of that stuff sounds like what a kind of teenager would say when they were desperate for attention. I'm not accusing you of making it up.
Oh, no,
what
here
I'm
we
saying
go.
Is,
that
do you
wasn't
understand
in the show.
How?
We're just talking now.
Sure, okay. But, you know, the Glastonbury taking mushrooms, chucking stuff out. Do you know what I mean? What I'm getting at is that you are... I'm fascinated with your relationship to the truth, and I think you are very honest, and I think you've got fascinating thoughts and very funny thoughts about the world and the way the world works, the way offence is created, the way, you know, all sorts of different things like that, love, death, all the rest of it. But I also think that that intellect that you have is married to a sense of you as still being that wild-eyed loner that you really want to prove to us how deep you are and how exciting your life is. Does that resonate with you at all, or am I
look
just...
Look at everyone going, how are you not offended? And yeah. Because that's really funny. And not only that, I always argue that self-awareness does not come from within. You know, the only thing... You know.
Yeah, that's another brilliant sort of soundbite that sort of sounds clever, but I don't really know what you mean.
Okay. Don't you?
Not really, no. I think it's funny, and I buy it. I buy the surface Brendan of, like, bang, slick thing, but I know that in there, there's a really intelligent, emotional Brendan that isn't kind of getting away with stuff.
Self-awareness, that's the soundbite, but then I'm going to elaborate.
Okay.
But you've called me on it.
Okay.
But that's okay.
Okay. I feel I know you well enough too, and I really appreciate that. You
no,
know,
that's
you
okay, because it's because everything that I've said thus far, you said, oh, he's going to come along and talk about anger, and at first I was a bit offended because I was like, are you basing this on late night shows? Because at late night shows, it's, you know, and sometimes I do get that from comics going, oh, we saw you screaming in a room full of people.
Yeah,
at
sure.
Live.
I've seen you up the creek or somewhere like
and
that.
And I'm going, that's because it's a room full of cunts. It's a room full of cunts, and not only that, if I was to judge every other comic based on their performance at Late in Live, they're drunk and they forget their jokes, apparently.
Yeah, well, some of them do, not all of them do, and not all of comedians deal with a room full of cunts by screaming and shouting at
them. But you know what?
You chose to do that.
I do, but generally it's because, well, first of all, the deafness helped, because a room full of people booing isn't really that scary if you can't hear them. They just look like cattle. And... but also, I have a really very defined, I guess, code and sense of justice.
Okay.
That I do believe there's an us and a them, and I never liked it when someone got booed off and the comic that went up after them sold them out.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
right?
I appreciate
just to
that.
Get themselves
yep.
over, right?
Yep.
I've never, ever liked that. I understand why people do it and they feel it's a survival instinct, but sometimes I've seen them be like, all right, this is going to sound sexist, but... Sometimes, say if it's like, okay, you know what? This is a bit condescending. It is. I realize it now. It occurs to me. But sometimes if there's like a camp gay guy mm-hmm. and they're really mean to him, or there's like a softer spoken girl and there's just a room full of assholes bullying them.
Yeah.
That's generally when you'll see me just be aggressive from the top. I don't like that room and I don't want them to like me. And quite frankly, I'm appalled by the way they treated the person, mm-hmm. my compadre,
sure.
beforehand. And I feel that I have some of the tools to basically tell the audience what they really are.
Mm. Yeah, you absolutely do. I'm not questioning that at all.
And I don't think that some people necessarily have those tools or it's not part of their persona.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's always been part of my persona, if I lose my rag, you know, and I can do mock outrage well.
Sure.
And sometimes when I get really...
But
angry.
I'm talking about the real outrage. I'm talking about the real anger that's inside you and how you...
I think that gets in the way of comedy now. Like I said, this
sure,
shit,
no, and I certainly...
Everything I said was painfully unfunny.
Okay.
I think it really gets in the way of what's really...
But isn't that honesty getting in the way of it? That anger, that's an honest thing. And what you pride yourself on is being able to talk about the real shit and be really honest with the rest of it.
I've written jokes about it, and I've written jokes about Stu, because he seems to be at the forefront of comics slagging other comics.
Yeah, definitely. And I've noticed there's a bit of a kind of Stuart Lee backlash. I've seen a couple of shows where people have mentioned him or done jokes about him.
Well, you know,
because
what?
That's the circuit
reacting
to it.
You're going to do jokes about other comics.
Yeah.
Your act completely. Better be fucking bulletproof.
Yeah, yeah.
And telegraphing your callbacks ain't exactly made of Kevlar.
That is, again, practically in code. But we'll do a sheet, a handout afterwards.
Did that make sense?
Yeah, let's.
If you say at the top later on, I'm going to do something that makes sense, that's telegraphing your callback.
And
Chekhov's
gone.
Huh?
Like Chekhov's gone.
Like, oh. You're smarter than me. I didn't know. explain that to me. What is it?
Yeah. In Chekhov plays, if there's a gun above the fireplace in the first act, it needs to go off in the third act.
Yeah, it's a general rule of drama. It's a Hitchcockian thing as well. If you see someone hide a gun in the first act, then
Chekhov's gun,
then it's got to be fired at some point.
So
otherwise,
there's this sort of fake, better phrase than the telegraphing your callbacks that I've come up with.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same thing. Yeah, sure, but it was a brilliant attempt to show off a good concept. So But what it's about, what the Chekhov's gun thing is about, the idea that there's something smouldering there and you are ripping off the audience if you don't then take it out and show it to them later on. Because you're kind of creating drama where drama didn't exist.
Okay.
Which brings us neatly back to the honesty of what you're giving the audience, of how you're marrying your actual experiences to a funny idea. And the reason I'm asking about this is because this is something I aspire to. This is my last three shows have all been attempts to heal myself ultimately by writing about stuff. I mean, my last show was called Prick because I was writing about kind of sexual selfishness and some bad things that I'd done. And I find, and this is, well, maybe we'll just take a different tag here, I find when I am trying to write stuff about my own faults and failures, I often find it too difficult to do. And I end up in a room typing away and looking at a thing and kind of trying to be honest and fucking... I sometimes end up crying and getting depressed because I'm talking about what a shit person I am.
And having an argument with yourself.
Okay.
Having an argument with yourself, and basically the thing that I do the worst, that I've probably done a bit off here as well, is I have an argument with the England that lives in my head.
Okay. Yeah.
You know? And it's like... I even did a gag about it last year of just going, take that, England that lives in my head. England doesn't think I'm clever. And then I'm like, England doesn't even know who you are.
Yeah. So how do you separate the England that, like, or rather, what is the relative value of an argument with the England in your head and an argument with the actual England out there, the genuine individuals in the room who are listening to you, who are receiving you?
Yeah, it doesn't exist. It's made up in my head. It's also, look, it probably stems from... All right, we're going to go deep. It probably stems from my dad's a genius, a bona fide, world-renowned chemical engineer,
sure.
Bona fide rocket scientist,
yep.
Invented the punctureless tire,
mm-hmm.
It was involved in putting out of the Q8 oil fires. Bona fide, super genius.
Mm-hmm.
I look a lot like him.
Okay.
As a kid, everyone presumed I'd inherited his brains.
Sure.
So then if I took what many people thought Alan Burns' brains and applied them to some pretty world-class cunt jokes, it wasn't exactly the crowning jewel.
Sure.
Right?
Would it be fair to say that because your dad was an inventor and, I mean, presumably he was quite wealthy and you came from a quite wealthy upbringing?
No, my family came from a caravan in the Australian outback.
Okay.
That's why the classes thing really bothers me.
Okay.
I've lived all three socioeconomic classes during the course of my life. And I have to say, I wasn't really necessarily a fan of a lot of the people that came in later.
Okay.
That came into the fold later.
Sure.
I'll just leave it at that.
Sure.
You know, but also on my mum's side, rough as guts. Really like outback, thong-wearing Aussies. And I spent a lot of time with them too, you know, because they were away on business a lot. So I had both upbringings in tandem going on a lot. And... I saw quite a degree of inauthenticity in the upper classes.
Okay.
And also I saw it in the middle, and I saw a lot of snobbery and a lot of people thinking they were better than other people. And I, you know, just growing up in this, I was like, but very confusing morality.
Okay. So let's talk about authenticity. and your desire to be honest and your desire to be authentic.
Oh my God, when, I hope no one listens to this.
When you were in your wild-eyed loner leather jacket phase,
on my own, and also no one young was starting out in comedy in those days.
Sure.
There's only a few guys still around that did the open mic circuit with me when I was 19, 20. That was like Nick Wilty, Nick Revel was around then.
Yeah. Did you feel you were being honest then when you were wearing the leather jacket? Was that you being honest or was that you trying to sort of live a...
Are you talking about me now or me then?
Let's talk about you then and then...
I didn't have a fucking clue who I was.
Okay, let's talk about you then, now then.
Yeah, I didn't have a fucking clue.
You didn't know who you were, but were you trying to be honest through the kind of posturing, aggressive stance that you took?
I was just very, very
broken. Were you kind of faking it?
I was very brokenhearted and trying to hide myself, and I discovered cocaine, and that was, you know... I did a lot of coke and speed.
Okay.
It's that simple.
Before gigs, were you on drugs on stage?
Yeah. Yeah, all the time. And cocaine.
So you could see when people go, he's a bit aggressive on stage. Possibly that's where that came from.
But yeah, when people came to my solo shows, I was very warm and engaging because I was more than moved that they bought a ticket to see me. And also, I mean, there are people still to this day that come to shows that I'm on a first name basis with that I gave a flyer to in 1996 on the Royal Mile. Mm-hmm. And they've stayed with me all this time. So when I see them, it's like there's family coming back.
Sure.
So it's you probably see a far more gracious version.
Well, I think you are a lot softer now in your performance. I was talking to someone in the queue last night before your show, a Scottish guy, and he was saying about how... He said he thought you'd calm down a lot. There was a big stag group behind us that in the end didn't get let in. They closed the door just before the stag group got in. They were singing and all the rest of it.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. Well, I think it was the stand going, we're full now. And, you know, just letting you get on with it.
Oh, you know what? That's good to know. Because I was like, hey, hang on. It said sold out and there was empty seats.
Yeah, well,
I'm now
going to
go and suck them off.
Right. Yeah. Well, you should, yeah.
Good
so
call.
So I was chatting to the guy in front of me and we were like rolling our eyes at this guy, this group singing behind us. And we, you know, I said something.
But to be honest,
along the lines of, you know, well, at least if they come in, at least we know Brendan's got the gears to deal with it. Unquestionably, you do. But what the guy said was, yeah, but he's, you know, he's a lot sort of softer now. He's been coming to see you for years. He read your book, all the rest of it. He said he's a lot softer now. And I wonder if whether... I kind of agree with that. I think you're...
It's been 8 years.
Yeah.
It's been 8 years of that. It's funny, actually. We were playing poker at my house. With a bunch of comics. And there's a bunch of guys I see a lot, and Ben Norris was over. He doesn't, you know, because he's got triplets, he hasn't been able to come out much. Mm-hmm. And he got a bit drunk and he nearly spilled salsa on my new carpet. And I went, don't do that. What are you doing? Oi, drunky, what's your salsa? And he goes, you've changed. and the thing is, that wasn't where everyone laughed. Because where everyone else who's been hanging out with me and close friends, I went, not in 8 fucking years I haven't. And sure. Everyone went, yeah, no, he hasn't. He's been like this for a long time now.
Okay.
It's not news anymore.
And so what was the change for you? Was it stopping drinking? Was it to do with your shows? Was it to do with you?
It was a complete and utter emotional breakdown and a proper psychotic episode. And I completely lost everything and I did the 12 steps and everything because of my life. Mm-hmm. It was such a mess. I don't do that stuff anymore, but I have complete respect for it. I know some people tend to be cynical about it. But the fact of the matter is, if you're so broken and you fucked up your life so much, you need some structure. You need some order to piece it back together again. Mm-hmm. And you need to do it piece by piece. And you need help to do it. But now it's not a big deal. You know, I think I was talking to another guy who's like 20 years sober, and it's kind of one of those things of. But it's you know, the first thing they say to you is, all you have to do is change the way you do everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, I suppose, sound bites were things, conclusions that I came to, and maybe I'm not too bad at wording things,
sure.
Except for that sentence. that wasn't practice. That was
no,
brand
no,
new.
I believe
Fuck you.
I believe you.
And that's where I kind of did discover self-awareness doesn't come from within. It has to be objective point of view. It has to be from outside input. So no matter how much you might hate someone's opinion or perception of you, there still has to be something there, and there's still something to learn from and to take from it. You know, I think every comic that has any degree of success learns how to sift through criticism, what's worthwhile and what's just utter drivel.
Okay.
All right. But also, second of all, you learn not to really get such an ego about your show. You just want to put on the best show you can, and you're not sitting in the audience.
Yeah.
You want to stay true to yourself and what you want to do, but if you've got someone outside saying, oh, this could go here or that could go that, always consider it. Mm-hmm. And my wife even said to me yesterday, you've got to stop, you know, I know the way that you work with everyone else, but when you give notes to other people, you don't sugarcoat it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, it's because I'm usually just, you know, we've got a job to do.
Yeah.
I was just, maybe that's my dad in me. I'm very pragmatic. There's no, you know, it's, you start off with the art and then you get here and then you start to get into the science.
Sure.
You start to get into the bones of entertaining a room full of people for an hour.
Given how many shows you've done here, given your history, given how sophisticated your shows have become now, there's a lot of intellectual stuff in there. There's a lot of ideas that you're...
I don't know about that.
I think there is. I genuinely think there is.
I think...
When I've been listening to lots of comedy recently, loads and loads of comedy research for this, I've got to your shows and I've gone, oh, great, Brendan's going to say something. You know, because you are. That's the stuff that you do. My question was going to be, what are you going to keep saying things? Are the next 10 years going to be another 10 Edinburghs for you? What's the plan? What's the plan for the going forward? Are you going to need to continue having revelations about yourself? What do you see as your future?
There's no revelation about myself in this. It just turns out I was deaf.
Okay. Okay, I don't necessarily mean a revelation about yourself.
There's a lot of jokes to be had there of what, you know, what it was like and what it's like now.
Sure.
I see what you mean, and if I can be Uncle Brendan for a second.
You can, totally.
Yeah, when you were saying you're looking for solutions in shows, they're not there. Don't try and find them in shows. You'll drive yourself crazy. Anything that happens in your life that hurts, you know, it's catharsis is, all right, I have practiced saying this, but it happens to be true. Catharsis, I think, has been bastardized into quick fix. Right? Catharsis is an excuse, a get out when people aren't being funny.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that what I have a new rule of just something happens in life that's painful before I fucking start mining it for comedy. Because, you know, as they say, plus time, comedy, you know, tragedy plus times equals comedy. But I give myself time to process these things in real life first. You have to. And you have to come to acceptance before you start writing about it and turning into comedy. Because if you're turning into comedy, you're looking for their laughter to heal you. And the fact of the matter is, you walk away every night coming down and you get up and you do the whole thing all over again for 28 nights in a row and you'll drive yourself fucking nuts. There is no solution in a show. There is no revelation in a show. It's just you're tapping your life, you know, for... You're trying to be who you are. You're trying. I mean, that will never end. That will never end. That pursuit of trying to be complete and whole on stage, who you are, and what makes you a funny individual, and you know, and it'll never be for everyone. It'll never be for everyone, and that will never end. That process will never end, and it only just becomes easier, and you just get better at doing it. Look at how many guys now, like in the States, they're having that renaissance period of people are really starting to appreciate guys that have done 20 to 25 years.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're becoming household names. But they were guys that were just going along and just really trying to just keep on chipping away. And it always happens when you stop caring.
Well, I was going to say, what is your attitude? And we've got to close with this now. What is your attitude to success, to your success? Are you satisfied with the amount of success that you've had, that you currently enjoy? How do you measure it?
How do I measure it? I can be very succinct about this, actually, is being able to make a living, but I never have to apologize for something I've said because I'm too well known. I think that's the perfect balance. Like, I even addressed it in the show. I toured with a guy called Mick Foley, who's just crazy famous, and it's such an intrusion. And I realised, wow, I never want
you
that
never
in my life.
Be like that.
And I know people can't get their heads around that. But I look at, like, people, you know, we both know famous people. It's a fucking hassle. Mm. It's a real hassle. You know, but I make it, as they say, 10,000 true fans, and you can make a living for life. You can make a living for life. That's all you need. And there are so many people that are doing that now. And I mean a great living. Sure. I mean, you know, holidays, second home, you know, pay off your mortgage, job done, live your life out. I mean, the next thing is Barry and I are working on a screenplay based on the book. Then if I shoot the film, that will probably be my final life's goal done.
Great.
And then I'll be fucking miserable.
That's all we've got time for. Ladies and gentlemen, we're slightly overrunning, so we've got to get done. No, it's my fault entirely. Would you please give it up for Mr. Brendan Burns?
God, he was pressing, thanks, wasn't man. He?
Thank
he was
you.
Very pressing.
So that was Brendan. I think some people have said to me that the shows from last year, the live shows, maybe got into less depth than if I was just sitting around someone's house interviewing them for 2 hours and could sort of pick the best bits. But I really feel, I'm very proud of these conversations because I really feel that although they are a shorter snapshot perhaps of where someone is, I do think we're getting into some depth. So keep listening. Do please tweet at me at ComComPod. Get in touch, info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd care to. With any questions for any of my upcoming guests, they're all at the website, www.comedianscomedian.com. And if you do fancy tweeting with the hashtag EdFringe in support of the podcast, or just to tell the world to flood the internet with the knowledge that it's happening every day at 5:15 p.m. in the Gilded Balloon, guests including Bo Burnham, Sarah Millican, Al Murray, all of those still to come, then I would be enormously grateful. Sorry if this one's a bit thrown together in terms of the chatting part. Probably you can't tell the difference, but to me it feels a bit thrown together. I'm in an enormous hurry. So I'm off now to interview Andrew Maxwell. So that one will be coming around before too long as well. Keep listening, keep enjoying the show, keep telling your friends, share it around. I really appreciate you all listening to it. Thank you very much. This is it's only now up here doing the podcast as a main show rather than a side show to my stand-up. Doing that for this year in Edinburgh, I've really become aware of how proud I am of this show and how grateful I am to all of you for continuing to support it and listen to it. Thank you very much. And this must be true because my girlfriend points out that this is the happiest Edinburgh I've ever had. It's an awful lot less introspection and self-loathing. Good luck to everyone who's doing shows up here. I've seen some absolutely brilliant ones. I'll go into those more detail next time I speak to you. Thanks a lot.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about it.
Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.